This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia accuses Ukraine of terrorism after Moscow was targeted by a swarm of drones for the first time since the start of the war with Ukraine. At least 46 Palestinians are injured during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. And France threatens to ban Twitter from the EU if the American social media network fails to abide by the new disinformation regulations in the bloc. Hello and welcome to World News, coming to you from Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Russia this hour, where the capital, Moscow, has been targeted by a swarm of drones for the first time since the war with Ukraine began. Russia has slammed the move as Ukrainian terrorism.
This morning, the Kiev regime carried out a terrorist act in the Moscow region, I emphasize, on civilian sites.
Well, the drone attack targeted several areas, including a suburb where Russian President Vladimir Putin has an official residence. Earlier, Russia said all 8 drones involved were downed by its air defenses. The Russian Defense Ministry said it was Kiev's biggest drone attack on Moscow. Russian officials said no one was seriously injured and there was only minor damage to buildings. A Ukrainian presidential aide denied Kiev's involvement, but said it's watching the developments with, quote, pleasure, and forecasts more attacks to come. Now, the raid comes after multiple Russian drone strikes on Ukraine's capital, Kiev, killed one person and wounded 4 others. We're going to cross over to Moscow, joined by Johnny Miller. Johnny, good to have you with us. Well, tell us the information. I know earlier we talked to you in the day, and basically you said that there wasn't a lot of damage. Can you tell me now, after hours, the overall assessment of how much damage, what took place, and do they know exactly that these drones come from Ukraine or not?
Yes, but I went to one of these sites this morning. It took me a while to find the exact site. Moscow is, of course, a big city, and the damage really is very minor, a few broken windows, not much more than that. I spoke to some of the residents who were living in that block. They were more bemused than anything else, and irritated that they had to be evacuated from their apartments at 6 o'clock. There wasn't any kind of anger about a strike from Ukraine because they weren't very successful. Russia is saying that in some way or another they've shut them down or stopped them, these attacks being successful. So minor damage, no casualties. But it looks like the response from Russia may be a lot more than breaking a few windows inside Ukraine. Of course, a kind of almost a mass drone attack on Russia's capital is being treated as a very serious thing here in Russia. Interesting, Vladimir Putin's words earlier today. He said that a few days ago, Russia hit the military intelligence headquarters in Kiev. Very difficult to know how successful Russia's strikes are in Kiev because there's a media blackout. Ukrainian citizens aren't allowed to film the damage. Ukraine puts out propaganda saying they always shoot down all these missiles. But clearly Russia is having success. Vladimir Putin suggesting this drone strike may have been a response to Russia's hitting of a decision-making center. And indeed, Vladimir Putin warning in words earlier today that because of this attack, Russia may well start striking decision-making centers in Moscow. So we'll have to wait and see, but this may well be a pivotal moment in how Russia is dealing with this conflict.
And Johnny, what's the word on the street there you're talking to? I'm sure you've talked to some residents today. I mean, their overall feel about this war, and do they think that it's about to escalate, or overall their opinion of what's going on?
Well, one woman did tell me, who lived in that block, that she said this is just the beginning, and echoing many people's words, feelings that this war can escalate further. The Russian ambassador to the UK just a few days ago in an interview with British television echoed Vladimir Putin's words some time ago, saying that we've only just started in this conflict, meaning that Russia has the ability, the military capability, to launch far greater and more destructive strikes on Ukraine. So that's the words that are coming out of Russia at the moment. But there has been many other instances of Ukraine escalating, and Russia hasn't done too much about it. So we'll have to wait and see how serious the Kremlin sees these drone attacks on Kiev. But in terms of people in Moscow, people aren't too worried. I see a lot of headlines in certain newspapers saying Russia's under siege or being attacked, being damaged by these drones. They're not really, and people here are quite calm and relaxed. But clearly, this Ukrainian conflict is much more likely to escalate in a dramatic fashion rather than de-escalate for the moment.
All right. Thanks so much for that update out of Moscow. That's Johnny Miller. Moving on to other news now this hour, Israeli forces have injured at least 46 Palestinians in their latest raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The regime's military stormed the Aska refugee camp in the raid. The main target was the home of two Palestinians who were shot dead by Israeli forces earlier this month, allegedly over anti-Israel operations. The troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets to disperse local Palestinians who confronted them, leading to the injuries. Nablus has seen intensified crackdown by the regime's military over the past weeks. Now, that's against the backdrop of almost daily Israeli raids across the West Bank. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, joined us earlier to give us more on the latest Israeli raid on the West Bank city of Nablus. Let's take a listen.
This time, Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Askar East Nablus in order to map the homes of two Palestinian martyrs in the Askar refugee camp. The first one, Hassan Qabdani, he was killed after the Israeli military accused him that he was responsible for the shooting that led to the killing of three settlers in the occupied West Bank, as well as the home. The Israeli forces took the measurement of the home of Hussam Salim, another Palestinian martyr, and the Israelis accuse him for being responsible, who gave the orders for the killing of one of Israeli soldiers last year, also in the occupied West Bank. During this operation to map the homes of the two Palestinian martyrs, clashes took place between the Israeli forces and Palestinian residents of the Askar refugee camp. And we have to mention that, of course, Palestinian fighters live inside the Askar refugee camp, of course, or they came from other areas and they clashed with the Israeli forces because the Israeli military claimed that they came under fire. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said at least 46 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces during the operation to Askar refugee camp.
Well, we have discussed the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in our news review program. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. First, Mona Candil out of Ramallah, and Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Mona, can you fill us in on the latest and what has taken place today?
We have to mention that Ibrahim spent 11 years behind bars, and then he was released. He was an officer of the Palestinian Security Forces, according to the Palestinian Authority. It's not clear whether Ibrahim engaged in direct clashes with the Israeli forces or not. However, the Israeli military issued a statement saying that its troops came under fire during the raid to Jenin City, and that they wounded eight Palestinians. One of them was in serious condition. Six others were arrested by the Israeli forces in Jenin. The Israeli soldiers seized with them from Jenin the weapons and other military equipment.
Thank you, Mona. Well, Charlotte, I mean, already the Palestinians basically are living in this hell that Israel has created. And now it's hell on top of hell as they exacerbate these attacks. What's going on? Why do we see the regime? I mean, on a daily basis, unfortunately, we're reporting about more and more Palestinians being killed. Why are we seeing this at this time?
Unfortunately, I mean, the Zionist regime, since its inception in 1948 and before, has always followed a policy of attempting to eliminate the Palestinian people from the land of Palestine by all means, including, you know, by direct force and violence, through extrajudicial killings, through the confiscation of land, the demolition of houses, and all of that for over 75 years has failed to break the resistance of the Palestinian people. But what we also see is that whenever there is a growth in resistance, the Zionist regime is dedicated to wipe that out. It wants to just absolutely suppress Palestinians from struggling for their freedom and struggling for their liberation and struggling even for their most basic rights. And so in an attempt to crush that resistance, we see these brutal raids taking place night after night, the invasion of houses, the explosion of doors from people's homes, the demolishing of homes that are owned by entire families in order to impose collective punishment on a Palestinian prisoner. All of this is an attempt to erase and suppress the resistance of the Palestinian people that the Zionist regime has been unable to do for 75 years.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this news review. Mona Kandu out of Ramallah, Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. And thank you for being with us on this news review. Now turning to France, which has threatened to ban Twitter across Europe if the American social media network fails to abide by new disinformation regulations in the bloc. French Digital Transition and Telecommunications Minister Jean Novart said the EU cannot take the risk of a network such as Twitter because it's the hub of disinformation supporters. He described disinformation as one of the gravest threats weighing on democracies. The EU will enforce new social media rules starting this August. Barrett's threat comes 2 days after the EU Internal Market Commissioner announced that Twitter had withdrawn from the bloc's voluntary code to fight disinformation online, which other companies pledged to follow. Azerbaijan is hosting the Israeli president and his high-ranking delegation despite public backlash in the Caspian Sea country against the normalization of ties with the regime. Isaac Herzog landed in Baku and received an official welcome from Azerbaijan's first deputy prime minister earlier on Tuesday. Herzog has met President Ilham Aliyev, whose country opened its embassy in Tel Aviv in March. The Caucasian nation also appointed its first ever ambassador to Tel Aviv in December of last year. But people are angry over Baku's diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. Azerbaijanis are not the only people rejecting their government's move to normalize ties with Israel. People in some Arab states have also voiced their opposition to a U.S. brokered normalization deal between their rulers and the Israeli regime. The head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting has visited Lebanon as part of efforts to boost Tehran-Beirut cultural ties. During his trip, Peyman Jebeli met with senior Lebanese officials as well as the Secretary General of the resistance movement, Hezbollah. Our correspondent in Beirut brings us more.
RIIB Chief, Iran's national broadcaster, Peyman Jebeli is on an official visit to Lebanon, where he has met top officials. A meeting with Lebanon's culture minister was seen by both figures as significant in order to boost bilateral cooperation on all levels, especially in the cultural sector.
As we had together faced the threat of military war, we together must face together in collaboration this cultural war, this war that intends to destruct our awareness of what in real is happening in the region.
The highlight of the trip was a tour to towns in southern Lebanon. Head of the IRRB told reporters as he overlooked occupied Palestine that the resistance has recorded a historic achievement after inflicting the heaviest defeat on the Israeli regime when it was forced to withdraw from Lebanon. But this victory is something that needs to be honored and protected by the media.
We, the media, with our role to narrate these stories of heroic stances, victories, and highlight the significance of what occurred, have a huge responsibility. A military operation would be limited in space and time, but the job of the media needs to persist in all places and at all times. My presence here as head of the IRIB, and in this town of Marun Aras, which overlooks occupied Palestine, is a symbolic and hopefully practical statement of unity and joint efforts with our brothers in the media of resistance.
IRIB CEO told reporters that this visit is aimed at strengthening the unity and cooperation among media outlets which support the resistance.
As part of the effort to form, as in the military field, the resistant groups could do a coordinated effort and form the coordinated operation rooms. High on agenda was that to form the same unity among the resistance media. So as part of that, he had meetings with high-ranking Lebanese officials and people in the resistance groups.
Mr. Jabeli had met earlier with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, who discussed some new and bright ideas on ways to cooperate with all resistance media, especially in Lebanon and Palestine. During their meeting, the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting and Hezbollah Secretary General both stressed the need to strengthen other facets of resistance, namely to confront the mass media campaign, which targets the people of the region. Maryam Saleh from Marun Aras, South Lebanon.
And with that brings us to the end of this Worldness edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
ای in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. For a couple of episodes, we have dwelt upon the views of French thinker Michel Foucault on Imam Khomeini. Today, we are going to make you familiar with the views of another thinker who has also paid attention to the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the character of Imam Khomeini. He is Hamed Algar, teacher of Islamic Studies in Berkeley University of California. Stay tuned, please. Hamed Algar was born in Britain in 1940. He has taught for years as the professor of Islamic Studies and Farsi language in Berkeley University. He is also a specialist of Shia history in Iran and the Naqshbandiye mysticism in the Central Asia, India, Turkey, and the Balkans. Algar has got his BA and PhD from the University of Cambridge and also an honorary doctorate from Tehran University. This thinker embraced Islam and then Shia school of thought. Algar has translated into English some works of the contemporary Muslim thinkers like Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, Ayatollah Taleghani, and Dr. Shariati. He has also translated some works of the great leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. He said in an interview in 2003 that he had first concentrated his studies on the contemporary history of Iran, but then extended his studies on other regions. Algar has traveled to various Islamic countries such as Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan, and his writings have been translated and published in different languages. He had a private meeting with Imam Khomeini shortly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Hamed Algar believes that in January 1979, when the Shah escaped from the country, it became definite that the Islamic Revolution would triumph. Algar maintains that the appointment of Shapur Bakhtiar as the prime minister by the Shah in the waning days of the latter's stay in Iran was doomed to failure and had no chance of success. Contrary to what the American statesmen thought in the final days of the life of the despotic regime of Pahlavi, there was no possibility of military coup in Iran. 2 weeks after the escape of the Shah, Imam Khomeini returned home after nearly 15 years of living in exile. Then, within just 10 days, the royal system was toppled and the Islamic Revolution triumphed. British thinker Hamed Algar considers this revolution a great event from two aspects. Firstly, the people's participation was unprecedented in the movements of the 20th century and even the centuries before. Secondly, the revolution was unique in terms of ideology, organization, and above all, leadership. He writes, "Generally, every big and small city in Iran was mobilized against the Pahlavi regime and men and women from every social class showed their inclination to overthrow the royal regime and end being the stooge of foreigners. The first examples of uprisings and protests against the regime or foreign meddling, such as the Constitutional Revolution in the first decade of the 20th century or the struggle after the Second World War to nationalize the oil industry, had failed to mobilize the people in such a broad and deep manner. Hamed Algar is of the opinion that the irreligious forces like nationalists and left groups had no prominent personality to be able to mobilize and organize the masses of people who are ready to sacrifice their life for achievement of an ideological goal. He continues, "There was no other person in Iran to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his call." British researcher Hamed Algar says the role of Imam Khomeini was not just a symbolic role of ethics, inspiration, and leadership. He was considered the practical leader of the revolution, although some of the Iranian activists would give him views on detailed issues. He would make key and important decisions himself, and from the very beginning, he shut the mouths of all advocates of compromising with the Shah through insisting on the dissolution of kingdom and establishment of the Islamic government. Without this insistence and the competence of Imam Khomeini to keep the loyalty and obedience of the Iranian masses, this victorious revolution wouldn't go beyond another transient and fruitless conflict in the history of Iran. It was the Imam who applied concepts like martyrdom and justice to mobilize the people and directed the nationwide descent toward a great change. Algar continues, "The 1979 revolution was completely Islamic in nature, and the participation of irreligious elements in it was absolutely marginal. For instance, neither the National Front nor the Tudeh Party played any important role in the revolution. Most of the persons who fought the regime in the final days of its rule, contrary to what has been claimed, were not the leftists, but the men of mosques and committees of revolution who were loyal to Imam Khomeini. They formed the main core of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps after the victory." Hamed Algar also says that many of the ulema sacrificed their lives for the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. Dear listeners, next time we will continue with his views.
Ocean of Dua. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wal'an adahum ajma'in. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were having a look at the concept of supplication from different points of views. What we concluded earlier was the fact that if we define supplication as asking in its broad and common sense, it will include all other kinds of definitions provided by literally scientists and everyone. So we may say that the word supplication refers to asking a superior one by an inferior one, or to asking by an inferior from a superior, or to asking of one from an equal one. This will include the genesis and innate asking as well. So the word of supplication, or dua, in the holy verse, and Allah invites you to the abode of peace, means asking for something. So, right now, I assume, we could say that defining supplication in this matter somehow does not solve any problem, unless if the intention behind its use is clear. The summary of this discussion is that if we can find different conditions in which supplication takes place, if we arrive at different definitions, and if we can analyze the cases of supplication, then the ambiguity of the word disappears. That's when we can subsequently arrive at our destination. And at the same time, what we have in mind when discussing supplication is the people's asking from their Creator and establishing relation with Him through supplication. This is what can be done either through the tongue of our hearts or through our ordinary tongues. So, I assume we'd better start our discussion with the question, is supplication necessary? What makes us supplicate? To answer this question, we resort to this verse of the Holy Quran. It says, قُلْ مَا يَعْبَأُ بِكُمْ رَبِّي لَوْلَا دُعَاءُكُمْ. Say, my Lord would not care for you were it not for your prayer. This means supplication is the only way of the relation between the servant and their Lord, and it is the only way commanded by Allah for people to have relations with Him. In other words, all of the supplications narrated from the infallible Imams establish relations between the Creator and the creatures. Allah would cut His special favors if there were not these relations established. In such cases, Allah's subjects would lose the ability to deserve Allah's favors. The Holy Quran calls this state pride, istikbar, a kind of state by a creature that originally has no prestige except for the prestige of being Allah's humble servant. The verse says, وَقَالَ رَبُّكُمْ أُدْعُونِي أَسْتَجِبْ لَكُمْ إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يَسْتَكْبِرُونَ عَنْ عِبَادَتِي سَيَدْخُلُونَ جَهَنَّمَ دَاخِرِينَ. And your Lord says, call upon me and I will answer you. And surely those who are too proud for my service shall soon enter hell abased.
I remember when I Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable. Knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Now, having this kind of istikbar or pride that we talked about, doing such a crime by an individual is obnoxious. And its insolence is inexplicable, so much so that Allah has explicitly announcing that such individuals will be deprived of His favors. As a conclusion out of these verses, we can understand that why the Holy Quran, through different means, has invited man to use supplication. For instance, the previous verse that we mentioned, وَقَالَ رَبُّكُمُ ادْعُونِي أَسْتَجِبْ لَكُمْ إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يَسْتَكْبِرُونَ عَنْ عِبَادَتِي سَيَدْخُلُونَ جَهَنَّمْ. Your Lord says, "Call upon me and I will answer you, but on the other side, those who are too proud for my service, they are the ones who enter hell abased." Or this verse, وَأَنِيبُوا إِلَىٰ رَبِّكُمْ وَأَسْلِمُوا لَهُ مِنْ قَبْلِ أَنْ يَأْتِيَكُمُ الْعَذَابِ. Return to your Lord time after time. Submit to Him before there comes to you the punishment. ثُمَّ لَا تُنصَرُونَ. Then you shall not be helped. Or the Almighty Allah says, يَهْدِي إِلَيْهِ مَنْ يُنِيبُ. He guides to Himself him who turns to Him frequently. وَمَا يَتَذَكَّرُ إِلَّا مَنْ يُنِيبُ. Elsewhere, the Holy Quran says, and none minds but he who turns to Him again and again. The Holy Quran, in other verses discussing the different aspects of supplication, says, وَالَّذِينَ اجْتَنَبُوا الطَّاغُوتَ أَنْ يَعْبُدُوهَا وَأَنَابُوا إِلَى اللَّهِ لَهُمُ الْبُشْرَى. And for those who keep off from the worship of the idols and turn to Allah, which means supplicate to Him, try to establish connection with Him, they shall have good news. Now, a cursory look at these verses reveals 2 points. One is the exposure to severe punishments in cases where supplication is left aside. And the other thing is getting Allah's special care and favors if supplication is used sincerely. Concerning this issue, there are numerous traditions in different books like Kafi, like Biharul Anwar, that have dealt with the matter to such an extent that no sufferer or miserable person could bring excuses when not practicing supplication. It is narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in Mahajjatul Bayda, "Inna inda Allahi manzilatan la tunal illa bil mas'ala." There is an honorable position near Allah which can be earned only through supplication. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
ولا تتفرقوا فيه
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب
In the limelight.
with just a few days to go before the United States was projected to hit the debt ceiling and run out of funds to pay the nation's bills, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Joe Biden have struck a deal to suspend the debt limit. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. With just a few days to go before the U.S. was projected to hit the debt ceiling and run out of funds to pay the nation's bills, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Joe Biden have struck a deal to suspend the debt limit. And Congress is expected to vote as soon as this week. Under the deal, the debt limit will be suspended until the first quarter of 2025. Beyond the 2024 presidential election. Rather than raising the debt ceiling by a specific dollar amount, suspending it allows Congress to define a period of time before the debt limit would need to be addressed again. Taking this approach ensures that it can be used for political advantage during the presidential campaigns. It leaves the next fight over a debt ceiling for a new administration and Congress soon after the 2024 presidential elections. Republicans originally sought a 10-year cap on spending at fiscal year 2022 levels and called for dramatic cuts to domestic spending unrelated to defense. The Biden White House proposed keeping spending at fiscal year 2023 levels for 2 years. The deal does not return spending to 2022 levels and instead keeps non-defense spending about flat, with current 2023 levels for 2024. There are no budget caps after 2025, just spending targets. For 2025, the agreement allows a small increase in non-defense spending of about 1%. The White House and Kevin McCarthy's negotiating team agreed on overhauling the country's permitting laws, an issue long advocated by moderate Democrats. The provision aims to streamline the environmental review process, designating a single lead agency to be tasked with environmental review that corresponds with a clear public timeline. Energy permitting changes are expected to speed up the time it takes to approve new projects, which environmentalists have opposed. Republicans are touting the deal's change as the first significant reform to the National Environmental Policy Act since 1982. The deal also says that unspent COVID relief funds will be clawed back, a proposal made by Republicans and accepted by the Biden White House. The COVID public health emergency officially ended in early May. The exact amount available is unclear, but the Congressional Budget Office has estimated it's about $30 billion. Republicans have also sought to toughen and add work requirements for able-bodied adults without minor dependents applying for entitlements and benefits, including Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, and also Medicaid. The White House has pushed back. The deal does not add work requirements for Medicaid. Currently, people eligible for SNAP do not have work requirements after the age of 50. The deal would raise that age to 54. At the same time, SNAP would see temporary changes that eliminate work requirements for veterans and those experiencing homelessness, regardless of age. Republicans also wanted about $71 billion in IRS funding over the next decade to be cut, passing legislation to do so upon taking the majority in the House of Representatives and including the same cut in the debt ceiling bill the House GOP passed last month. They were targeting tens of thousands of new agents funded by the Inflation Reduction Act, and even campaigned during the midterm elections on cutting the additional IRS funding, which was aimed at modernizing the IRS and improving enforcement against high-income tax cheats. Republicans told midterm voters that President Biden and Democrats planned to send an army of 87,000 IRS agents to audit everyday Americans to dig deeper into their pockets to pay for unfunded liberal programs like student loan forgiveness. According to Representative French Hill, Republican of Arkansas, who appeared on Space the Nation program the day after the deal was announced, the agreement would stop the first year of the 10-year increase in the IRS budget. He continued by saying that would be nearly $2 billion of spending stopped of that $80 billion that was to be spent over 10 years for hiring IRS agents. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. US President Joe Biden has set a bipartisan deal to raise the $31.4 trillion US debt ceiling and avoid default is ready to move to Congress and urge lawmakers to pass the agreement he struck with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. "This is a deal that's good news for the American people," Biden said at the White House on Sunday night after a phone call with Kevin McCarthy to put the final touches to a tentative deal struck the previous day. "It takes the threat of catastrophic default off the table, protects our hard-earned and historic economic recovery," Biden said. "I strongly urge both chambers of Congress to pass this agreement." He added, he believed the House Speaker negotiated in good faith and expected him to have the necessary votes for the 99-page bill to pass. Asian shares and U.S. stock futures rose on Monday, buoyed by news of an agreement. Lawmakers in Washington were set to see the details of the deal with the aim of putting a bill to a vote as early as next Wednesday and avoiding a catastrophic and unprecedented debt default in early June. Both the House and Senate are expected to return on Tuesday after Memorial Day holiday. Kevin McCarthy said the House will vote on Wednesday, then send the bill to the U.S. Senate. Once the bill reaches the Senate, where Democrats have the majority, the pace of action will largely depend on whether any senators try to hold up the bill, possibly with amendment votes. That could tie up the legislation for a few days. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York warned on Sunday that due to the time it may take to process the legislation in the Senate without cooperation, senators should prepare for potential Friday and weekend votes. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell applauded the agreement and called on the Senate to act swiftly to pass it without unnecessary delay once it has gone through the House. Mitch McConnell said today's agreement makes urgent progress towards preserving our nation's full faith and credit and a much-needed step towards getting its financial house in order. Chip Roy, a prominent member of the Republican Hardline Freedom Caucus, tweeted that he would try to prevent the agreement from passing the House, but Kevin McCarthy dismissed threats of opposition within his own party, saying over 95% of House Republicans were overwhelmingly excited about the deal. "This is good, strong bill that a majority of Republicans will vote for," Kevin McCarthy said. "You're going to have Republicans and Democrats be able to move this to the president." Earlier, President Biden told reporters, after attending the high school graduation of one of his granddaughters in Delaware, that there were no sticking points left between him and Kevin McCarthy.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.